And for myself, it's a great privilege to be introducing Jack McPanji tonight. Jack isn't just known as a poet, however, and quite often the attention drawn to his poetry is at the expense of the attention that I feel also should be drawn to his mind. He does have a PhD in linguistics. He's a very talented teacher, and his research, which may indeed either bring down or transform post-colonial studies, is quite something, and we may hear a little bit more about that tonight. But the reading is going to be from his books of poetry. After the reading and after the session of questions and answers, there will be an opportunity to buy the very few books that are left here after a spending spree that took place before this event. I am assured by the bookshop that book orders will be available here. You can order these books, and of course Jack will be around next week and the week after at various points, including Writers at Warwick events, to sign them. He'll be able to sign your books after the event too today. Can I please welcome Jack McPanji?
Thank you. Good evening. And I thought I should just make a little introduction to the reading tonight. I've divided it into two sections, just since there's some people who do not know who I am. The first part of the reading is going to be just general poems leading on to the poem which may have caused me imprisonment. And then after that, I'll read a couple of poems about imprisonment. And then perhaps a slightly happier poem or poems after. I started writing poetry with the influence of African oral traditions. And the first poem I still remember writing as a young man, very young man, was a poem when we were all wondering what the role of the writer and the poet is. And I thought the writer and the poet was like a rainmaker who fails to produce rains. And I put this idea in a few lines. The first poem is called The New Platform Dances, which was conveniently published at the time when platform shoes were in the vogue, which they're coming back, I gather. The New Platform Dances. Haven't I danced the big dance, compelled the rain so dust could soar high above, like when animals stampede? Haven't I in animal skins, wriggled with amulets, rattled with anklets, scattered nervous women with snakes around my neck, with spears in these hands, then enticed them back with fly whisks magic? Haven't I moved with all concentric in the arena to the mystic drums dancing the half-nude long-way dance? Haven't I? Haven't my wives at mortars sang me songs of praise, of glory, how I quirked the earth, how my skin trembled, how my neck peaked above all dancers, how my voice throbbed like the father drum I danced to? Haven't they? Now when I see my daughters writhe under cheating, abstract voices of slack drums, lured to babble idea men masks without amulets or anklets, why don't I stand up to show them how we danced chopper, how it was born? Why do I sit still? Why does my speech choke like I have not danced before? Haven't I danced the bigger dance? Haven't I? Then he danced the bigger dance, and he went to the metropolis to see what was happening there. And everybody said, go to the metropolis. Drink the water from its source. And this skeptical young man discovers there isn't very much source there. drinking the water from its source. Distancing ourselves now, our metaphors sharpen. We say drink the water from its source naively, probably thinking of its purity, our salvation, or the dead empire. We know only too well that all water springs from sources so inscrutable. Yet drinking water far from the sources, we often exalt our images, heedless of the minor details. Streams gather debris from antique sunspots, depositing the silt onto infinite sandbeds. The sliding Shire River mystifies us, watering our golden lives. And tantalized, we then conclude the source of the waters must be more exotic. But drinking the water from the source is like a prayer. After we have slipped out of our sandals, washing our gray feet for the moment, we only seek the point of our troubled voices, hoping thereby to reassemble our broken confidence. We know that after the prayer, we'll slip back into our sandals, buckling more dust, probing greater salvation. Again, watching the hour when the muezzin should raise his voice for another congregation. Drinking water from the source, we must turn back to the peripheral mosaics of home, revealing the depth of their natural negatives. The next one is the impression of this young man, the metropolis. Comes to London and goes to watch football at Anfield. Goes onto the train and discovers that everybody is doing that. The newspapers, nobody is greeting him at all. So he compares the two trains. He has just left Choo Choo train in Africa. He comes to this more civilized one. First train to Liverpool. No last minute haggling about prices of curry chicken, first at Balaka. No stinking Afro wigs into your mouths. No leaping from bags of peanuts into baskets of tomato, cheerfully quarreling. No finally sitting on half a batter. Houston Station. Contracts and dialogues through wires and innumerable papers. Only comfort welcomes aboard a sudden silence that soon reigns, our eyes weighing and quickly avoiding each other between the beverages and the local papers. Runcorn Station welcomes aboard a haunting quiet, where men obviously build more paper walls against other men. No curios, no mats, no herbs sell through windows. No mothers suckle their crying babies. No jokes about the reins being held up by your charms this year. At Lime Street itself, not even a drunk staggers out, perhaps announcing his newly acquired cornerstones. Only recorded voices bid you come again before the engulfing, impenetrable crowds. But the maddening quiet soon recedes, locating a bright, tarnished face once known. And then he goes back home. And discovers that even that is not as interesting as it ought to be. He comes back to the metropolis and he is asked a question. What is it like this second round? And he says this in a letter at the metro, old irrelevant images. They're still so anthropologically tall here, still treating you in irrelevant tribal metaphors. Somalis have softer skins, they drink milk, they say. And yours is cracking, you drink kachasu. Even the most knowledgeable slip back, apologizing to you in banal Tarzan images. The children still know mostly Tarzans at school, they say. Tarzans choked me too, damn it. But the college girls sit in about rapists was a bit of a change. And Mrs. Thatcher's, etc., against overseas students. And the publisher's dinner. How are the jacarandas are left blooming otherwise? And then in 1979, again as this fellow is a young man, youngish, getting older, he is asked, because 1979 was chosen as the year of the child by the United Nations. And a BBC friend says, hey, why don't you write a poem about the year of the child? And this was my refusal to write a poem about the year of the child. Without kings and warriors, occasional verse fails. Skeletal Capuchia children staring. Cold, stubborn Irish children throwing grenades. These are objects too serious for verse. Crushed Soweto children clutching their entrails, then in verse roost mocks. Today, no poet sufficiently asks why dying children stare or throw bones. And why should we compute painful doubts that will forever occupy us? Talking oil crises in our eight cylinder cars is enough travesty. The year of the child must make no difference then, where tadpoles are never allowed to grow into frogs. Thank you for your silence. It does get deeper and deeper and more serious, you know. Then he goes back home and he discovers that these very important people, fat-necked and so on, are living on lies. When I went back home in a village called Kadangu, discovered everybody was starving. But the government and everybody important, even in the university, we were told not to say that we were starving. But this type of dishonesty is what writers write about. Kadango village, even Milimbo Lagoon is dry. In the cracking heat of October, our village market, a queue of skeletal hands reaching out for the last cow-like tin of loose grain falters against hope. In the drought, a frail dog sniffing his lover's ass goes berserk, barking at the wave of ray eddying between the mountain boulders and the shriveling lake. Scurvy children kicking the grit scud beachwards, their wobbly feet digging in for possible cassava, where even such tubers are now hushed in shoot. Rocky geckos, blue tongues hanging out, scuttle on the hot sun, but biltong belly up before the beach. Fish eagles suspended swoop down for grasshoppers. Even Milimbo Lagoon is dead. Nor all deep seen anymore. Those fishermen who dreamt up better weather once no longer cast their nets here. And their delightful bawdy songs to bait the droughts are clocked in the choking fumes of dawn. Banned. Our fat-necked custodians dispatch another tale. This little one is occasionally writers indulge in predicting doom. The doom was predicted in 1981 when this little piece came out in London magazine, but it happened in 1991, 10 years after, of our chiefs and their concubines. Last Christmas, they sat beside the hearths, secure, together, cracking roast chestnuts, or stale jokes about hollies and ivies, as red wines cooled down another hot year. Today, even the vines threaten to stream the streets with banners of another fire. I read you a little poem, which was supposed to be the poem that I was supposed to have been arrested for, but they didn't discover it, because it was tucked away in Portrait of Wales, and the authorities didn't see it. I saw it after 8 years. That's why I was arrested. The event is interesting. The only thing that needs explaining is those of you who civilize us there, when you go, you say we should indulge in child spacing. And the locals say child spacing is geographical. So one here, one in Nottingham, and another in New York. Space your children this way. But I went to maternity ward where my wife was, and I was told I am out of bounds because in the maternity wing of the hospital men are not allowed to come in. But I saw what was going on because the president was coming that Christmas. So I thought I should make him just write a few lines to please myself. I called them Out of Bounds, or Our Maternity Asylum. I was out of bounds, they insisted, outside the wards, where iron roofs crumble under rotting mlomba leaves. Green paint rusts to 2 decades of dead dust. Windows are covered in shreds of matting. Inside, some 60 inmates of spasming women top and tail on 30 beds. 90 others with infants scramble over the cracked, cold cement floor. A family under each bed, mossed in between. A fresh-smelling babe in the corner grinds. Mother suckles him, gnawing at her tatters. On a slab, a cramped enamel plate with a piece of tripe she could not chew, labors. But this is no asylum, and no one is fighting the desert war here. These are refugees only from child spacing, atoning for the ghost revolution 20 years ago, prepared in this shrinking hospital, God knows how. And I gather the doctors and nurses who toil 24 hours with blunt needles, without drugs, on a small wage, offered to extend this wing. There was the usual hiccup about official clearance. Yet this was the rallying cry of the dares once upon a time. And when the powers visit the sick at Christmas, some caesareans will be prematurely discharged. Others jostled into neat lines, clapping their praises. The windows will have been glazed, the blood-bespattered walls painted. They'll borrow beds and canvases from the nearby hospital. So Father Christmas sees one patient per bed. Another dream done. But I hear I am out of bounds. And he was out of bounds. Went into prison, this young fellow. I never told him why. Some of them said it was the verse. In prison, where there was no writing, one still wrote in the head, in the hope that when one got out, then what had been written in the head could be recovered. Something to keep alive. One of them was inventing something to do. For instance, when we were moved into one cell, which was very dirty, we called for water. And the walls were full of graffiti. One piece was particularly exciting, we thought. So we called for water to clean the place up and leave that little bit about as our little anthem, scrubbing the furious walls of Mikoyi. Is this where they dump those rebels? These haggard cells stinking of bucket shit and vomit and the acrid urine of yesteryears. Who would have thought I would be gazing at these dusty cobweb ceilings of Mikoyi prison, scrubbing briny walls and riddling out impetuous scratches of another dung beetle locked up here before me. Violent human palms wounded these blood-bloated mosquitoes and bugs to survive, leaving these vicious red marks. Monstrous flying cockroaches crashed here. Up there, the cobwebs trapped dead bumblebees. Where did black wasps get clear to build nests in this corner? But here, scratches, insolent scratches. I've marveled at the rock paintings of Mbonzi Hills once, but these grooves and notches on the walls of Mikoyi prison, how furious, what barbarous squiggles. How long did this anger languish without charge, without trial, without visit here, and what justice committed. This is the moment we dreaded, when we would all descend into the pit alone, without a wife or a child, without mother, without paper or pencil, without a story, just three Bibles for 90 men, without charge, without trial. This is the moment I never needed to see. Shall I scrub these brave squiggles out of human memory then? Or should I perhaps superimpose my own, less caustic? Dare I override this precious scroll? Who would have known I'd find another prey, without charge, without trial, without bitterness in these otherwise blank walls of Nikoyu prison? No, I'll throw my water and mop elsewhere. We have liquidated too many brave names out of the nation's memory. I'll not rub out another, nor inscribe my own more ignoble, to consummate this moment of truth I've always feared. How much time have we got? Okay. The next one, which is another prison one. One of the things we used to do in prison was, because you have this Bible, it comes to you, and because once a lecturer, so you're teaching once, you string various stories and invent audiences, and you talk to these audiences. So one of the stories I did was string the stories of ravens from the Bible. And what happened was this. The cell where we're living in had iron roofs, and the ravens used to come at 4:30 in the morning when we're just about to get our sleep. And so I asked this old man who had been in prison 17 years without trial, I said, where do they come from, these crows? And he said, you are asking me, you come from the university and you have dustbins in the university. You've got to be crazy. So I thought I should write a few lines. The famished, stubborn ravens of Mikuyu. These could not be known as ravens. These crows of Mikuyu prison groaning on our rooftops each day. Wherever they wandered after their bungled pilgrimages in the aftermath of those timeless floods, Noah's ravens could not have landed here. They never returned to their master's ark. These could not be Elijah's ravens either, for however stubbornly this nation might challenge Lord Almighty's frogs, his devouring locusts and the endless droughts and plagues, today there is no prophet God so loves as to want to rescue with the bread and meat from messenger ravens. These can only be from that heathen stock of famished crows and carrion vultures sent here to peck at our insomnia and agony-blood eyes and to club the peace of this desert cell with their tough, knocking beaks. And why don't they choose some other place and some other time? Why must these crows happen at Mikuyu prison, always at dawn, hammering at the corrugated iron of this cell, drilling at the marrow of our fragile bones, and picking at the fish bones, thieved from the dustbins we ditched outside? Read one last one from prison, and then we move on to the new stuff. This is by way of commercial, skipping without ropes, that's the latest one, which you must get. Uh, It's based on a fact. We were not allowed to do any work at all in prison. Again, as I suggested, you invent life. Man is, or woman, is so strong. So, because we were not allowed to work, not allowed to read, and you wanted to go for a shower, you couldn't go for a shower if you were not sweating, so you decided to skip on one spot. And you, when you had sweated enough, you called out to the guard to take you for a shower. The point that is important about this is what also true about what I've been saying, I think. The trouble with dictatorships and the trouble with the world, colonialism, dictatorships or whatever, is that they want to make us all children. And imprisonment is the embodiment of that. And we all refused to, or we were trying to refuse to be children. Skipping without a rope. I will. I will skip without your rope, since you say I should not. I cannot borrow your son's skipping rope to exercise my limbs. I will skip without your rope, as you say, even the less I want will hang my neck until I die. I'll create my own rope, my own hope, and skip without your rope. As you insist, I do not require to stretch my limbs, fixed by these fevers of your reeking sweat and your prison walls. I will skip with my forged hope. Watch, watch me skip without your rope. Watch me skip with my hope. A one, a two, a three, a four, a five, I will, a seven, I do, will skip, a 10, 11, I'll skip without, skip within, and skip I do without your rope, but with my hope. And I will always skip you, Tao, will skip your silly rules, skip your filthy walls, your weevil pigeon peas, skip your scorpions, skip your excellency, life, glory, I do, you don't, I can, you can't, I will, you won't, I see, you don't, I sweat, you don't, I will wipe my gluey brow, then wipe you at a stroke, I will wipe your horrid, stinking, vulgar prison rules, will wipe you all, then hope about myself, my home, the mountains, my globe, as your sparrow hopes about your prison yard, without your rope, without your hope, I swear, I'll skip without your rope, I declare, I'll have you take me to the showers, to bathe me where I can resist this singing child you want to shape me. I'll fight your rope, your ruse, your hop, as your sparrow does under your supervision. Guards, take us for the showers. Read two more. Okay. I don't know what time it is. 1 minute. It's late. Okay. Well, in that case, I'll read a light one. A very, very light one. There is this Malawian guy who wants to get married to this, he's in England now, it's Durham Cathedral. He wants to get married to this Welsh girl, and the parents don't like it. It's an old story. So this boy says, Uncle, can you come to my wedding and try write a poem for me about this? So in Africa and in Malawi, at weddings, we pick up a hoe for the man and kitenge, cloth, for the woman. And my wife ordered this especially from Malawi. So I thought I should read this one. Perhaps we can finish that with this one and then we decide to discuss, I can answer by reading another poem. Chitenje for a lifetime wedding cheer. And tonight, when the uncles, aunts, and elders gather beside the nervous light of the flaming candles and paraffin lamps, when they spread their ancient mat from timeless baobab tree trunks on your floor, and they invite you both to consummate their exultatory tales of heroic wedlocks of long ago. Neither weep at their bolded tales nor waste your lamentation in silent capitulation. For you are nobler people, neither bonded to the elders nor their tales. And mind these elders. They tend to define things in easy black and white. You deserve subtler shades of color. God has endowed you with rare brown, delicately drenched in rare pink, wedded to precious love. So, when we offer you this traditional hoe, this chitenje, we do not mean you to dig the rolling green valleys of Wales or mystic mountain ranges of Malawi. For hoes are signs and chitenjes mere covers, outward icons. The serious business of love and tolerance begins when you smile after your first quarrel. And eyes sparkle at each party. May this hole then, this chitenje, and these words bring you the wedding cheer of a lifetime.
Some water, Jack. It's question time.
Thank you very much.
So they wouldn't let you work at prison, eh? You went to prison, and they wouldn't let you work, and here you are at Warwick.
Yeah, well.
Will they make you do both?
I'm skipping without ropes, and I'm hoping that Warwick has a solution to some of the ropes.
That advertisement was brought to you by the Warwick Writing Program. With his usual flagrant determination to overturn the university. I remember a story, actually, when you first arrived. I think I was on one of my manic two cultures blasting, fundraising voyages around the university. And it was the first day that Jack was here. And Jack, I said, Jack, you know, forget the English department for a moment, let's go to computer science. It's great there. So we went over to computer science, and Jack ended up making a speech to the PhD computing scientists, which was good. And we voyaged back, and Jack, we should be doing this with the business school, I said. And I think you finally brought me down to the ground with the phrase, David, you should be an African. So I want to turn that around back upon you and ask you the question, the first question, and I'll open it up to you. Why do you write in English?
Oh, yeah, I should be an African. strangely, I write English as a revolution against something or other. Do you know, I give an answer to that question, which is not common to a lot of people. I did not choose to write in English. In the same way, I did not choose to become a Catholic. I went to a place where there was no Catholic, there was no Anglican church. The nearest was Catholic. So I just joined in, especially when they said our gods didn't exist. I said, well, you know, might as well take some of these gods and find out whether there is anything interesting in them. Now, Dr. Banda came to Malawi. He was a good man. And then, for some strange reason, he thought that he was a linguist because he was one of the informants, is that the word? Researcher, yeah? For Edward Sapir, the American linguist Edward Sapir. And Dr. Banda actually gave information to him on the structure of Bantu languages. And if you are a linguist and you pick up the issue language, the 1937 supplement of the issue language has a grammar of Chichewa, which was provided by Dr. Banda. Now, that spoiled the whole thing. What Dr. Banda did not tell Edward Sapir is that he was giving him the dialect of his own Chichewa, Chilianja. And so when he came back, he imposed that as the national language of the whole country. And we were to write in it the way French Academy sometimes causes people to, or used to cause people to write specific words and so on and so forth. Now, unfortunately, I was not very good at that, Chichewa. And he stopped us from speaking out, writing, using creative writing in our languages. My mother's language is Chinyanja, which was in fact the language, and Chichewa was a dialect of Chinyanja, but Banda turned that around. And my father's language is Chiao. Now, I would have happily written in Chiao, except I could not write in Chinyanja or Chiao. So I said, well, I don't want to use his language, I use English. That's why I write English. Now, I'm afraid I'm stuck with it now. because Malawi is free. Banda was booted out several years ago, and he died last year. The new government has given freedom to everybody to use their language. I can now technically use my language. Off on the car and spitting and so on. These are things that have come through. But do you know, having, as my daughter says, yes, it says here, this is the answer to your question. It says here, the delight of moving house, Tang Ho. When we first arrived in Tang Ho, the children welcomed us by stealing glances at us, sniggering over the hedge, meeting about the front door hedge after school, spitting loudly, monkey faking without ambiguity, until some started throwing eggs at our windows, sometimes writing fuck off on the windscreen of the car we had bought near the scrapyard. Okay, that's the bad side of the story. And then my daughter laughs. How dare crowds of Tang Ho kids do this to chaps rescued from the jaws of African crocodiles? You can see this tongue chicken in her. And my second daughter says, I wish they gave us the eggs they waste on our walls. and my son sulks and just continues mending his bicycle. My wife, who is mopping the kitchen, says, hold on, children, what lies here? And I said, mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. But that ends on an interesting note, actually. Because it ends on slowly these children begin. When you're a foreigner, except that we don't do it in Africa, I mean, it happens here. We don't call names through this. The rudest thing that I can remember people saying about white people in Africa is that we used to call them, especially the missionary type, when they were working so hard and they were sweating and the skin went red and so on. We used to call them red tomatoes, rotten tomatoes. That's the most racist thing I can think of in my life, to be honest. But I never saw the things I saw in York. But then the other side has a compensation to it. I'm at Warwick University. Not only that, a book has just been published by the Dutch, who are always exciting about these things. They've published a book on the 50th anniversary of 50 years of Declaration of Human Rights, where everybody is in it there. Anand, Tony Blair, you know, tucked away there, there is a Mapanji. So I said, oh, that's interesting.
It's Jack's privilege to answer every question he can in verse, and it's your privilege to frame one in verse if you can. David Abney.
Can you start again?
The question concerns how important humour has been to you, Jack.
Oh, how important humour? Oh, yeah. Humour has been very important. Without humour, especially in prison, you can't survive. And we had to laugh at ourselves, laugh at how idiotic you are. I mean, okay, look, I have been arrested as a head of department, and I'm just about to become a professor at the age of 30-something. It's all gone. And then dumped in there, cold cement. No, you're given prison uniform. No underwears, a little blanket. And so when you sleep, that's your pillow. You get up and you say to yourself, who am I? Suddenly you realize you are a nobody. And you know, I wish a lot of people discovered that we are nobodies. And so we said, who am I? I am a nobody, okay. I'm a fool. What was I doing that for? And you need humor. If you don't have humor, you die. And in prison, you don't have to be killed by anybody. Just giving up a bit of humor is enough. You suddenly take yourself so seriously. I'm a professor and so on, so on. But you're no professor. You're just an ordinary little idiot sitting in a corner. So you need laughter. But we need more than laughter. We loved, don't call them lies, because we never used to call them lies. We used to lie to each other. You know, he would wake up today. You know, he did not dream anything. I had a dream today. Come on, sit around and see. I'm sure we're going to be released according to this dream. And you know, he starts this whole story about the dream that he never had. But somehow we are so polite, we know it's a lie, but we love it. We used to love to tell lies in prison, and lies for survival, laughter for survival. If you cannot have laughter, it's almost impossible to survive in certain situations, definitely in our situation. But that runs through. if I was, for instance, taking a typical example, if I was given a job in the University of Warwick, I would teach a course called Literature of Incarceration. Now I tried that at Leeds University. It's fabulous. But what is exciting is to discover that these the gulags and all these characters. You can go from wherever, from Reading Jail to Brian Keenan. You do a study of their work, it's fascinating how humor becomes so important for their survival. Otherwise, they would not come out. Sorry, I'm too long, but I thought.
But the literature of incarceration seems to be a great course.
Well, I had 80 students signed up for it, and because I was part time, I only taught 30.
Say the question. There was another person here. Julia.
Yeah.
The question is about whether the Englishness of Jack, to what extent his being in England made him more English? Or the in-betweenness of that translation?
It's a valid question. From the point of view of the readership, I'll give you a little experience I had in, and this is nothing to do with commercial now, this is a serious point. I read from, after the publication of Chattering Wagtails, I read at Huddersfield a poem which I wanted to read today, but I thought I would spare you that one. After reading it, it's a poem which I dedicated to my mother, who died 2 months before I was released, and I was not allowed to go and see him because of the rules of prison. So I read that poem to this crowd of about 400. They were actually snooker watchers with Carol Rumins. And there's a man at the back who started sobbing. I went to him afterwards. I said, "Why did you do that? You're embarrassing me." He said, "No, my father died and I haven't cried for him." In other words, where you are depends on your readers who read you. Influence, then I don't want to make it a simple question of I'm a hybrid of my world and here, because that's what it is. Now, I don't think you can say I am more European or more English than an African, because I still speak the African languages. I also speak the jokes, but not only that. I mean, I understand David Dabadin's jokes as well. sorry about that.
Whoever doesn't.
Now, one measure is like this. When I leave here to go to Africa, you suddenly realize how English you are. When you leave Africa, you come here, you suddenly discover how African you are. So it's a very difficult question. I am a bit of both. I don't think it would be fair of me to say I am more of one. Perhaps because I've stayed here for 7 years, I'm more here than there. But then I have been. I was in Harare and we had a huge time with the characters there. It's lovely. It was all African. I think it is a privilege, you know, to do a bit of both. I think the most exciting poetry being written today, British poetry, is is that which has a bit of Europe, a bit of English, a bit of America, a bit of English, a bit of India, a bit of English, a bit of Africa, a bit of English. I mean, some of the most exciting poets, friends of mine, have at least had one or two. A go at the so-called the unfamiliar ground. I think it's because of the global nature of the world. It's more interesting to not only talk about my own worries as an individual in Coventry, funny because Coventry Football Club lost the other day, but you go on beyond that and so on. So the global aspect is interesting. I don't know the answer to that question. I don't think I don't want to say I'm more English than etc. But one way of finding out is who reads you if you're a writer, if you are read more, and is it because of commercial, because the publishing house is better at publicizing your book in the UK or not? Sometimes that's a consideration.
Friend at the back. What is your responsibility for that, Jack? The voice meeting the responsibility for the society? That sort of power?
The Western world doesn't have very much of that, I mean, I think. But in Africa, not that I had any power, but the fascinating thing is how suddenly, if you published a poem, whether it is in the local language or in English, and this I have to say, somehow somebody thought you were doing something which was dangerous. Okay, the immediate question is, power and poetry, the poet has no power. I mean, imagine me, what could I have done against Dr. Banda? I mean, he had a whole army behind him, whole police force. I had nothing. All I had was a bit of a head, which was most of it was cracked during those days. And now it's reshaping in time for this session. But to be serious, writers do have a prophetic thing. The trouble with Africa is that in the early stages, most African writers were part of nationalism struggle. In fact, if you read very carefully Chinwezu and company in his book Towards the Decolonization of African Literature, he does actually say, almost accuses, in fact, that's the only thing that's wrong with that book, as far as I'm concerned, is that he's fighting Walesho Inka. Effectively, he was saying to Walesho Inka that you are playing too much to the Western world. You should be playing to your African world. Now, perhaps he was doing that, but in those early stages, writing was part of nationalism. You had to write to prove that you are anybody at all. You're no longer a slave, you're no longer colonized, you're no longer this, you can think for yourself, etc., etc. So the writer did play that role. I would like to believe that he ought to continue to play that role. With the new government in Malawi, and I don't mind saying this, I rang up the president the other day, and he says, you do have a nerve of ringing at this time of... I said, yeah, well, do you want a poem or do you want my nerve? And he says, what poem are you writing? I said, I want to write a poem about this corruption that you're supposed to be doing. He says, when you come here, I'll give you an appointment. And he gave me 45 minutes, actually. But perhaps I was a special.
Take a question.
The answer is yes, but what I'm saying yes to is a different, totally different thing, by which I mean, what I was actually doing, I think, is that I was trying to tell the truth. And I will continue telling that truth, regardless. It doesn't matter whether it's here or not. The only problem about which is special is that when you are not even accused of anything, because I was not charged, I was not tried, then the regime, what the regime was doing was even subtler, because it causes you to accuse yourself of having done nothing effectively. But what? Because nobody charged you. And so you went in there the first day in prison. You went in and you sat there. You said, nobody has taken me to prison. Nobody has charged me. I don't know how long I'm going to stay here and when I'm going to get out, if I'm going to get out. Because there had people had died 25 years in prison and they died there. So it's very difficult. But I would do it again, yeah. But I mean, I wish, we were saying in prison, I wish they charged me of having written a rude poem. Then I would have felt really, really good. But they didn't even do that.
Can I just continue the question? I know it's not obvious to everybody. The person who asked that question is actually my wife. That's why I didn't repeat the question. But just to take that a bit further, Mercy, your wife, was... with you all the way through the time you were in prison?
Yes.
Come to York with the children?
Yeah.
To what degree would you brave incarceration for the sake of poetry? Since, you know, we don't have any power over the dictators of our country. But to what extent we would do that for ourselves, and to what extent would you do that in relationship to your wife and children?
Agreed. I retract everything I said earlier on. Agreed. What I agree about is it is the case. Now, this is, though, it's coming out because of the experience I've had. I have discovered that once you have the laughter in prison, you can, if you like, you can enjoy imprisonment. Now that's stupid to say, but you can decide that I'm going to enjoy it here because I want to get out. What you do is decide to survive, and we said, if you survive, that's the only way you're going to beat the system. If you die, then Banda has won. If you live, then you have won. But there was the follow-up to it. After release, I look at what my wife has gone through. I look at what my children have gone through. And I say to myself, yes, I will accept, because I was a proud man. I did not want to leave my country. Banda made everything possible for you to get out if you didn't like him. You went into exile. You joined everybody. Now, some of us said, what right has he got to push me out of this country? I was born here. Now, at that, after release, then I was rather worried with myself. I said, perhaps I was being selfish. Because I looked at my wife and what she'd gone through, I looked at the children, then I agreed with the British High Commissioner, who said, according to our intelligence and that of the French and the Germans and the Americans, you're going to be bumped off, so get the hell out of here. So when the Yorkshire fellows were spitting, it didn't matter. I will not do it again for their sakes, because they, and I know that this may be considered to be stupid as well, they suffered more than I may have done. I had everything, blisters, and name it. We were suffering from chronic malaria every fortnight, a thing that I could not even put in my prison memoir because I don't want you to vomit. But after that, you laughed, and there was comradeship. But they were suffering for me. And it took 22 months for my wife and children and my family to visit me. There was, if it had not been for another form of surreptitious communication in prison, they would not have known that I was alive for 22 months. And so they suffered more than I did. So from the point of view of abstract justice, truth, etc., versus, which can come out through verse, versus survival of human beings, most of whom are my own, then I would rather I got them to survive. But I will not give up fighting for freedom, because that's what I believe in. As I was saying, I think we should have imprisoned Pinochet for 2 minutes so that he knows that he's in prison. Just to give him 2 minutes or 5 minutes. You are imprisoned for all the wrongs that you have done. If he knows that it's imprisonment, don't tell him the 2 minutes. Put him there. He will discover something and then release him. So, I didn't want anybody to ask that question.
Another question? The question concerns Jack's current writing, which includes the prison memoirs, indeed. And to what extent they are a disengagement from that experience in the past.
Yes, especially when I have the opportunity to finish it, especially the prison memoir. Once a prisoner, always a prisoner, as they say. But then you become a slightly different prisoner. As I say, skipping without ropes, wherever I'm going, I am actually technically skipping without a rope. But I would like to get out of it and write an interesting story. Just a different story, perhaps with no prisoner in it. Perhaps I'll succeed, but it's a tough job. But once you've been through it, And this prison memoir, I'm glad actually that I'm here, because I started writing it in 1994 at University of Leiden. They gave me 3 months writing residence there. And I wrote half of it, but I said, no, I'm not going to. And then now I've decided, no, this is the time, let's get rid of it, let's go into different areas. So I agree, once you're a prisoner, you're stuck with it. And what you can do is basically make the best of it, or if you're lucky, get out of it, write something different. I'm hoping to write something different.
Yeah, I mean, as a poet, you are in the profession of prediction. What sort of verse do you imagine you'd be writing in 10 years' time?
If I'm around, I don't know actually. I want to write a long poem. I don't know what it's going to be about, but I want to write a long poem.
Oh, you need a quiet, good place.
I need a quiet, good place to do it.
A room of your own.
Little room of my own, with a window overlooking the library.
Now, which library could that be? I wonder. I'm going to bring this to a close now. From a personal point of view, I found every minute of Jack's stay not only enjoyable but life enhancing. And I know that the students that he's dealt with have felt the same way. And those writers who have come from outside the community have had they've had the same impact upon the novel. I'd like to end in a way that we don't usually end a writer's at Warwick event, which is actually by asking Jack to read a final poem of my own choice. And it's this one. Another Fool's Day touches down.
After my PhD, I arrived in Malawi and I discovered everybody was celebrating. Dr. Banda didn't like Fool's Day, April 1st, so he turned it into a celebration of his own. So I was lucky. The British Council gave me an air ticket to arrive home on Fool's Day. And I was lucky because I probably have been arrested when I arrived. So I just arrived and there was nobody there at the airport, but everything was shut up, shut up, shut up. So thank you for choosing this one. Another Fool's Day touches down, shush. Another Fool's Day touches down, another homecoming, shush. Bunting, some anniversary, they'll be preoccupied. Only a wife, children and a friend, probably waiting. A PhD, 3 books, a baby boy, 3.5 years, some fit to put us. Shush. Such frivolities no longer touch people here. So you decided to come back, eh? Rhetorical questions, dredge up spastic images. Shush. In the dusty brown-gray landscape, the heat unrolls. Some wizard has locked up his rainbows and thunder again. Why do the gods hold up the reins? Don't we praise them enough? Shush. There are no towers here, no domes or gothic windows, only your children, friends, nestling up for a warm story. Thank you.
Jack McPanjie, thank you.